the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Is the idea of personal liberty the great theme of our civilization to such an extent that it becomes the one great moral force driving everything else? That is not a hypothetical question. Let me tell you why it's so important. It's because right now some very serious arguments are being made that all of our conversation about human sexuality, about abortion, about a woman's right to do this or a citizen's right to do that, it's all a false argument because the liberal side will always win. That's the argument that's being made right now. That any kind of restraint upon human freedom or human behavior or human orientation or human choices or whatever is doomed to fail. That is a very serious argument being put forth by some very serious intellectuals, and it has a lot to do with our public policy decisions. But I think it also gets right to the heart of what we ought to talk about today. And that is this: is there anything more important than unrestricted personal liberty? Is there anything more important than unrestricted personal liberty? Does anyone have the right to say no? Have we lost the right to talk about ought and ought not, and can and cannot in this culture? We'll be talking about that in just a few minutes. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, a review of some of the issues in the news. Right front and center in the news is the impending vote for Judge Samuel L. Alito to be confirmed now, within perhaps as few as 4 or 5 days, as the next Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. What has been fascinating in just the last several days, indeed the last several hours, is how Democrats have mounted a last-ditch effort to filibuster. And what makes this filibuster effort all the more poetic, as it is now falling apart, is that it is being led by Senators John Kerry and Ted Kennedy. And Senator John Kerry has launched his effort to filibuster against Judge Alito from Davos, Switzerland. That's right. It is the very first effort at a Senate filibuster ever undertaken from Davos, Switzerland. And it's not working. As a matter of fact, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada, who was against the filibuster and then later for the filibuster, just in the last couple of hours has admitted that the filibuster will not happen. The effort to filibuster this nomination has failed. And so Senator Frist, the majority leader of the United States Senate, says that a vote will go ahead on Monday for cloture, which is the Senate's rule to move to a vote, and then on Tuesday to the vote. Now, I just have to say, from a personal point of view, what must it be like for Samuel Alito to go through this? You know, I'm thinking about Judge Estrada, who pulled out of nomination to one of the high courts because he said, look, I can't put my family through this. I wonder how many can. I think this tells us something about how perversely rancid our democratic culture is becoming. Just think of the personal cost. And I'm not just talking about Mrs. Alito bursting into tears during the confirmation process. I'm talking about this extended and excruciating dance that means nothing in terms of democracy and everything in terms of political posing. And I'm not just throwing brickbats at one side. It is an indictment of our entire political process. You know, both sides need to recognize that the confirmation of judges to the U.S. Supreme Court is too important to be reduced to this kind of meaningless melodrama. But hopes for this kind of reform and getting back to a serious talk about serious issues is something that may be beyond the pale of our expectation in dealing with the current context going on in Washington. The other big issue in the news, of course, has to do with the election of Hamas, the great victory, and I say great, I mean landslide victory in the Palestinian parliamentary elections of Hamas, the most radical party imaginable. Now, a lot's going into this. Number one, the United States of America was pushing for this vote. It is a part of this administration's roadmap to seek to have a legitimate government for the Palestinian people. In the aftermath of the death in 2004 of Yasser Arafat, with the rise of what has been recognized until just the last 72 hours or so as a more moderate Palestinian leadership, the United States policy has been to seek to encourage the Palestinian people to elect a credible leadership. Well, they elected a leadership. And the party they elected as a majority, or at least a plurality in their elections, is a party that is representative of world terrorism and has pledged itself to the destruction of Israel. So now you have a situation in which the Israeli government says it will not negotiate with Hamas, and it can't. And as of just a couple of hours ago, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice announced that the United States will not negotiate with Hamas, and it must not. And we find ourselves in this very, very difficult situation. I've written about it at my weblog at Albert Mohler, that's MOHLER.com, just over the last 24 hours. What does this mean for Palestine? Well, it means, when I say Palestine, I mean in terms of the regions now under the authority of the Palestinian government. It means that they have now elected an extremist party that is absolutely committed to the destruction of Israel. Now, this raises the whole question about democracy, too, because is Hamas even committed to democracy right there in the Palestinian Authority? Here's one of the central dilemmas we face if you believe in democracy and freedom at the beginning of the 21st century. Does it mean, as former President Ronald Reagan once said, one vote, one time? Or does it mean an ongoing democratic process? You know, in electing a non-democratic party through the democratic process, have they now absorbed within their own system a time bomb, which will mean the very end of the legitimacy or the continuation of any kind of democratic experiment within the Palestinian Authority? We don't know. We're going to have to see. But I will just say, as many times as it must be said, that the democratic process is, as Winston Churchill so eloquently put it, the worst of all political systems tried, except for all the others. And we need to be real careful to make clear that we do not worship democracy. Because the Nazi regime in Germany was elected through a democratic vote. Awful things have happened through democratic means. It's the worst form of government imaginable, except for all the others. And, you know, we have an explanation for that as Christians. It has to do with the doctrine of sin. We know that sin comes out even in our political decisions, in our political negotiations, in our political parties and political machinations. And we know that's because sin will come out. And what makes democracy preferable to these other systems of government, and I say democracy meaning a representative democracy, is that it limits the concentration of sin in either a monarch or an autocrat or an ongoing political party of aristocrats. And in distributing power more evenly, it seeks to limit the pervasive and corrupting influence of sin. But it does leave you vulnerable to what happened in the Palestinian Authority here with the election of Hamas, their great electoral victory, and what this means for the current Palestinian premier and all the rest, who knows? It's going to be a very interesting few days. But when you put this on the table, along with the kind of threats coming from President Ahmadinejad in Iran, what you're looking at is a coalescence now of anti-Semitic, anti-Israel forces that can't be anything but subversive for the cause of peace. And I think that may be, if anything, just an understatement. Well, somebody has a birthday today. And that someone is Mozart. Yes, the great composer turns 250 today. You're looking at 2.5 centuries of Mozart. And this is a reminder to us that God sometimes has chosen the most unusual creatures for his glory. Mozart was, as a personality, well, someone who was so artistically gifted that by the age of 5 and 6, he was playing for the imperial courts of Hungary and Austria. His father was a musician. As a matter of fact, he grew up in a house in which music was very much the language spoken even more than words. He was so talented as a young musician that he could be turned over on his back with his fingers hanging on the keyboard and could play a harpsichord. He wrote the music that sounded like we can imagine the music in heaven might sound. But he was himself a person of very complicated moral character, a person of very little personal discipline, except when it came to the writing of music. Many Americans have some idea of Mozart's character and of the story behind his musical genius through the play and the film Amadeus. But it is an opportunity to remember that God has given us, through some of the most interesting creatures in human history, some beautiful art and some beautiful music. And if you don't enjoy Mozart, all I have to say is, Carl Barth had this much right. You've got no soul. You've got to enjoy this kind of musical genius. You can respect others, but in your heart, somehow, you've got to love Mozart. Folks, I learned a new word just in the last couple of days. This new word, you want to know what it is? It has to do not with patriarchy, but with kiriarchy. Yes, the feminist theologians, especially in this case some Catholic feminist theologians, have come up with kiriarchy as a word to absolutely insist that it is oppressive to believe in a lord or a king. Now, that's where democracy really goes rancid, when you say everybody's equal, even the Lord of the Church. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler program. Folks, when you talk about the idea of liberty, one of the big questions is just how important is it? How central is it to who we are? You know, when it comes down to the question of how we order our culture, it really comes down to whether we believe that liberty has no constraints whatsoever, or whether it's supposed to be something that finds its place within a larger worldview. Now, this larger worldview is going to be established by something that is even more important than liberty, more important than freedom. Now, I see I've already lost some of you because you don't think there is anything more important than liberty or more important than freedom. Just a few months ago, I dealt with this article by Peter Berkowitz of George Mason University School of Law, in which he argues that conservatives, or those who hold, like Christians, to enduring moral principles as more important than liberty, are losing. And his argument is that we are destined to lose this because Americans have now been drinking from the well of personal autonomy and personal freedom to such an extent that they really don't believe that anything can stand in the way of unrestricted personal expression. Whether it comes to their choices in sexuality, their choices in lifestyle, eventually the law, the government, the culture, the courts, all will have to come to terms with personal autonomy as the one great central non-negotiable good. Now, I wrote about that at Albert Mohler, that's MOHLER.com, just a few weeks and actually a few months ago. But now I find this article by Tom Teepan of Cox Newspapers, and I got to know of Tom Teepan when he was the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And let's just say he likes to hang around on the left end of the political spectrum. But he's written an article that has been picked up by other newspapers entitled Expanding Sexual Freedoms. And he says basically that every civilization has to come to terms with the licensing and expanding of sexual freedoms. And he says when it comes to our culture, this is just even more the case, more so the case, because we as a culture have embraced this idea of liberty, and inevitably it is now going to expand to every kind of liberty, including sexual liberty. He says this. He starts out by talking about Elton John marrying, in this new civil union law in Great Britain, filmmaker David Furnish. He says this. The Supreme Court of Canada also has ruled that group sex clubs are lawful if the participants are consenting adults, and many of Europe's topless beaches have long since gone bottomless as well. Now listen to his next paragraph. He says, none of this has loosed any broad rampage of wantonness, destroyed marriage, set off epidemics of sexually transmitted diseases, or collapsed civilization, always assumed by conservatives to be a frail creature vulnerable to the wash from any passing fad, when in fact it has proved itself hardy during centuries of such buffeting. He goes on talking about the controversy about same-sex marriage in the United States. He says it's going to happen. You know, conservatives may not like it. Christians may oppose it, but it's going to happen anyway. He says Britain's once harsh laws against homosexuality lapsed years ago. The military was open to gays and lesbians in 2000. Now gay civil unions, marriage in all but name, grant couples full rights. France, Germany, and Switzerland do the same. Holland, Spain, Canada, and Belgium have legalized same-sex marriage straightforwardly. And to think that just 17 years ago, Britain's Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and her Conservative Party barred schools and local governments from in any way accommodating homosexuality. There may be hope for us yet, says Tom Teepan. We're always slow learners in such matters, speaking of Americans. Now, just to crystallize his argument, it is that every single rule against any kind of human sexuality is destined to fall, to be delegitimated, to be cast aside, because Americans now believe that freedom is the only defining issue. Peter Berkowitz made the same argument. I picked up on it just several months ago, having to do with abortion and sexuality. I'm beginning to wonder if this isn't something that we really need to confront. I'm convinced today it's something we need to talk about. Is there anything greater than liberty and freedom? This is not just a hypothetical, some kind of pie-in-the-sky doctoral seminar discussion. This is where American citizens are now living. And to a frightening extent, this is the kind of worldview that shapes people, even when they sit in the pews of our churches. They hear what we say, but they filter it through this lens or this perspective of unrestricted, non-negotiable personal autonomy and personal liberty. The phone number, 877-893-8255, that's 877-893-TALK. Is there anything more important than personal autonomy, personal liberty, personal freedom? Let's go to Jenny, listening on XM170 in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jenny, your turn.
Hi, Dr. Mueller, blessings to you. I'm calling to comment. I believe that there is something significantly more important than liberty, and that has to be self-control. I don't have the right in my liberty to do harm or bad to someone else, and neither do they have the liberty to do the same to me.
Okay, Jenny, hang with me here for a minute. Let me just say that one Supreme Court justice put that argument in these words. He said, your personal freedom ends where your fist would hit someone else's nose. And that's the kind of argument I hear you saying here. But to extend that further, what about when it comes to laws against, for instance, pornography or same-sex marriage? You know, how would you reframe the argument in that case?
Well, I believe that those laws are laws because of the harm that these practices do to people who are engaged in them and to people, as in pornography, to the voyeurs who watch. There has to be some sort of moral code that we are answerable to and for in order for our civilization to survive.
Okay, Jenny, I really appreciate your argument, and I'm just going to reframe it slightly. What Jenny appears to be saying is that there is a law that is more fundamental than the civic law, and whether you want to call that the natural law, or you just want to refer to it as the common law given by God's grace, there is that law that is more fundamental than our civic law. You can take all the statutes and the law codes of all the 50 states and put it together with the federal codes, and somehow we have to know that there was a law before those statutes and ordinances were ever adopted. And that more fundamental law is that which has to determine what is right and what is wrong. And, of course, we as Christians would add to that God's revelation, in which we now have God's revealed law, and that's also by his grace. Appreciate your call, Jenny. Let's go to Carol, listening on XM170, calling from Boonville, Missouri. Go ahead, Carol.
Yes, I believe that God's law and the laws that he established for all people thousands of years ago before any of these people were born is the most important law we have to answer to now and through all eternity.
Well, I'm not about to argue with that, Carol, and I think what you've just said is a profoundly Christian statement. Let me ask you, when someone comes up to you and says, well, all right, that's good for you, Carol, you're a Christian, but what about Joe and Susie Secular over here? Why should they have to obey that law in terms of the American set of civic law? Why should they have to obey that if they're not Christians?
Well, because they need to realize that one day they will answer to the supreme lawmaker, whether they believe here on earth now or whether they learn when they stand before him in eternity.
All right. Well said, Carol. You know, Thomas Aquinas would have put it this way. He said, we need the law to teach us. We need the civic law to teach us what the moral law would instruct us. And thus, the law is a teacher. We talk about that repeatedly on this program. That's why law is important. It's because by the way our law is codified, by the way we put together laws and statutes and ordinances, we're telling citizens this is right and that is wrong. That's why, just to take one example, the issue of same-sex marriage is so important. It fundamentally changes the moral character of a civilization when the government says this, which you once thought was wrong, is now right. And we've changed the law to recognize that. Coast to coast, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Well, Tom Tiepen says that nothing trumps personal liberty when it comes to issues of human sexuality. In the article that he wrote that was entitled, at least in this newspaper, Expanding Sexual Freedoms, he basically looks at the fact that in Europe and in Great Britain, there has been this continued push for legalizing this and expanding that such that you now have even sex clubs that have been ruled to be legal so long as everyone consents. In Canada, you have gay marriage now, at least civil unions, domestic partnerships that are marriage and everything but the name. In Great Britain, you have gay marriage itself, called marriage, in the Netherlands and in Canada and in Spain and Holland and other places, so Belgium. So, you know, what about the United States of America? His argument is that we're just stuck in the mud, that we just aren't willing to go along with it. But he says, look, it's going to happen anyway. Those who don't want to see same-sex marriage, those who don't want to see the legalization of X, Y, or Z, are just going to have to realize that if these are consenting adults, it's going to happen because Americans are so committed to personal liberty that there's nothing they will accept that will put a boundary around that personal liberty. There's no limit they will accept. I want to know if that's an argument you will accept. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Adam, listening on the web in Mequon, Wisconsin. Go ahead, Adam.
I just wanted to say that I think that that's the most ridiculous argument I've ever heard. That would make consenting virgins sacrificed in satanic cults absolutely moral. I mean, once you say liberty, well, why don't I have the freedom to rape little children? You know, why shouldn't we have the freedom to do that? It makes morality absolutely impossible if you say this. And it reminds me of your debate that you had on a couple of weeks ago where you asked a guy for a standard, where this guy was asked for a standard. And he said it was basically whatever, you know, works for me. Well, that's not a standard.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's like if you were to invite people into your seminary and say, no, you have to come up to this standard, but it's whatever works for you. That's not a standard. It's like a square circle. In essence, what I would say is if you take the liberty position, it makes morality absolutely, completely, and totally impossible. And I think this position will end up falling in on itself.
All right, Adam, let me ask you, have you ever thought about, like, teaching as a vocation or anything like that? I mean, you got it, and I really appreciate that. And let me tell you what else I appreciate. You're willing to show you're worked up about this. So I now know I'm not alone. So thanks, Adam. I appreciate that from Mequon, Wisconsin. Adam, I want to ask you one other thing. Have you noticed how they shift this argument, though, to say that the only thing that boundaries or limits liberty is the issue of consent? So I think their quick response to your idea of sacrificing virgins or burning widows, as in this practice of suti in India or anything like that, is they would have to be by consent. But Adam, that's where I would have to come back as well and say, well, the practice of suti, of burning the widows, and just so we know what we're talking about here, in India during the colonial days, the Britons had to face the fact that the widow of a prominent Indian man was burned along with him, and she willingly went. Adam, when it comes to consent, how would you argue against that being the one issue that would limit personal freedom?
Well, I would say that that's exactly the point. If you wanted to take somebody says, I'm willing to be sacrificed, like as in the Aztecs as well, I'm willing to be sacrificed, be a willing human sacrifice, they would have to say, hey, this is moral. This is acceptable. And, of course, that makes any person, you know, with a God-given sense of morality just cringe.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because, you know, imagine saying, willingly saying, okay, put a knife through my heart, I want to die now. I mean, that just gives you a moral chills up your spine. But everyone, you know, is going to know that. But these people would have to say, that's moral, that's acceptable. And I just don't think that you can get away from the fact that you're going to have to go another route other than liberty in order to find some meta-ethical theory. And meta-ethical theories are in shambles right now. Anyone who knows anything about philosophy knows that.
Adam? I really do appreciate your call, and I just want to say that the very kind of horror illustration you've talked about is not just hypothetical, it's real. Just remember that we covered on this program not too long ago the fact that a man who intended to be a cannibal in Europe placed a classified ad asking for persons willing to be paid to allow him to cannibalize them, and he had takers. Now, they weren't going to have to die because he wasn't going to kill them. He just wanted body parts to eat. Now, Adam talked about chills going down the spine. I think that can lead to very clear physical reactions of disgust, just to think about that. But if personal liberty is the only moral principle, then you really don't have any response to that, do you? By the way, the radical libertarians in the United States are now pressing for the legalization of the sale of donated organs. So you say, well, I have two good kidneys. Maybe I could make $100,000 by selling one of them. Why would that be immoral? If liberty is all, we really don't have much of an answer. The number is 877-893-8255. You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program. Does anything trump personal liberty? A big question in today's America, because we are increasingly hearing calls for unrestricted personal autonomy, boundless personal liberty as the only moral principles worth observing and worth respecting. And this is the logic of the cultural left. We need to be really clear about this. The logic of the cultural left is that the unrestricted expansion of liberty is the great human story. And what they basically have as their own view of history is that human beings are progressively moving into the modern age, ridding themselves of oppressive and oppressive ideas that limited human freedom, and we're coming out of that dark age into the brilliant light of unrestricted personal freedom, and that must mean the freedom to change your gender, the freedom to say you are whoever you want to be, the freedom to define your own morality, the freedom for homosexuals to marry, the freedom of a woman to destroy the life in her womb, freedom, freedom, freedom. And what this society increasingly resists is any argument that comes back to say there's something more important than freedom. There is a right and a wrong. There are moral absolutes that are more important even than freedom. The only freedom we should genuinely respect is freedom exercised within those moral boundaries. The number 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Florence, South Carolina, where Mike's on the line. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. I just wanted to mention one of the problems that I have with that argument about personal liberty is that at the foundation of that is selfishness. And it's interesting that at the foundation of sin is selfishness. And people argue that you cannot legislate morality. However, morality is always legislated. It's just only a question of whose morality is being applied. And I think as people fail to realize that they're just indifferent to the idea that ultimate personal liberty will always result in sin.
Mike, a very clear statement. Thank you for that. And I really like how you went back to the legislating morality phrase, because that is something that's thrown at us all the time, and you got it exactly right. It's only a question of whose morality is legislated, the morality of the secular left or the morality of those who believe that there is very clearly a moral absolute, a moral truth, a natural law, a revealed law to which we are morally accountable. And those two conflicting worldviews are what underlie the great battle over legislation and over the cultural issues and the most contentious issues of our day. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Sherry calling from Greenville, Tennessee, listening on WHCB. Sherry, go right ahead.
Hi. I was just thinking that it's not actually, they're not pushing for free liberty. They already have free liberty. What they are pushing for is the absence of responsibility. God, in the beginning, gave us the choice to sin or not to sin. But when you choose to sin, there is a price for that. And one of the, if you choose the sin of homosexuality, you give up the choice of marriage. I just think that each, they're not pushing for free liberty. They already have that. They're just pushing against any sort of responsibility or any sort of reaction to their choice.
Very interesting argument, Sherry. I appreciate that. You know, there are people who are suggesting that the very consequences you talk about are really the fault of the society rather than the fault of the individual. Just give you one example here, and this is what was thrown at me on Larry King Live last week. You're going to hear this again and again and again. Just take the movie Brokeback Mountain. You have the two cowboys who fall into a homosexual relationship and a homosexual romance, and yet they both marry, and the marriages turn out badly, and other bad things happen. And so the take-home for the secular left in that is that it's a great story of human happiness denied by a repressive society. If we did not have our hang-ups about homosexuality, these two gay cowboys could have established their own household and been happily ever after. They would have avoided the pain of these two awful marriages and the trauma that came because of their homosexuality. They would have been freed the violence that at least one of them experienced and all the rest. And so you do have that argument coming from the secular left. Sherry, what you said is obviously true. I mean, it is virtually what Thomas Jefferson would have to have acknowledged in the Declaration of Independence, to have been self-evidently true. And yet what is so frustrating in our current cultural climate is that that truth is denied, because they will turn it often on the head and say that the very results you're talking about, the very products of human sin, the very responses of irresponsible behavior, the products, the conclusions, that these are actually the problem of the society rather than of the individual. It goes back to the big issue, and I've talked about this again and again. The great dividing line in America today can be illustrated. It's not just this, but it can be illustrated as to whether you think that the great moral crisis when it comes to same-sex behavior is homosexuality or what they call homophobia. You know, that's the great dividing line. Is it homosexuality that is sinful and wrong, or is it opposition to homosexuality and the belief that homosexuality that is wrong? Let's go very quickly to Abingdon, Virginia, where Lee's on the line. Go ahead, Lee.
Hello, thank you for having me. I was listening to your talk about freedom and the laws and stuff, you know, and if you look back at the Bible, you know, you can't have a government without God's laws. But as I was listening, I was thinking of an example, and if you look back at Rome and how Rome, you know, kept growing and growing, and they was absorbing all these cultures and just accepting anything as long as once a year they would worship Caesar, you know. And look at Rome now. Rome's not the mighty empire. And, you know, when you delve in sin and you play in sin, you have a payment. That's what Romans 6:23 tells us.
Appreciate that point, Lee. When you embrace decadence at the very heart of your culture, you take the poison pill of civilization. And eventually you do sow the seeds of your own destruction as a culture, as a society. That happened in Rome. And I think it's happened in the ruins of Rome in terms of Europe. European civilization is coming apart at the seams. It has embraced almost a death wish within itself because of the very thing you're talking about. That is the denial of any kind of moral absolutes and the rejection of the inheritance of Christian civilization upon which that entire culture was based. We have so many great people who want to call and make points. I'm going to rush to get Craig on the line here, listening on WFIA in Louisville. Craig, make your point.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Mueller. The Hamas woman that sacrificed three of her sons for personal political freedom, you know, that just shows you what it's coming to, what the world's coming to, what they'll do for personal freedom.
Yeah, Craig, and I especially appreciate the fact that your illustration points out that consent can't be the firewall here, because those suicide bombers or homicide bombers, they consented, and even their mother consented. You know, consent just isn't enough. When you hear things said as being, well, all right, because it only involves consenting adults, what kind of backdoor is that supposed to be? We'll be right back with some final thoughts. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. One of the things that excites me about this program, and is very satisfying, frankly, is having the quality of discussion we've had here today. An important question and some really insightful callers. So we're going to try to get two more in here in the closing minutes of the program. Let's go to Louisville, where Andy's on the line, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Andy.
Yes, I was calling to say that I believe there is a higher calling, a higher responsibility, a higher order to live for, and that is that to see God glorified in all that is done, and to see His glory uplifted above all else. And one of the things I think that happens by Christians seeking to not only live more transformed lives, but to see others brought into the kingdom to be saved. And so I think that one of the ways of addressing this issue is just by getting back to
to personal evangelism.
Well, that's true. It has to go hand in hand. And, Andy, you pointing us to the glory of God, you know, that's why, for instance, on Larry King Live last week, I was asked about Larry about why I had such a hang-up about homosexuality. And it's not just about homosexuality, is it? It's not just that these guys on this film are doing this thing. It is that they're missing the point for which they were created. And they're missing their opportunity and their obligation to glorify God in every aspect of their lives. That is the bigger picture. And we as Christians need to keep pointing to that. And that higher plane is really important in terms of not only how others understand us, but how we understand our own arguments. Let's go to Craig, listening on WTBN in Tampa, Florida. Go ahead, Craig.
Thanks, Dr. Moeller. I have one quick comment. I've noticed through some statistics that I've read about that in the countries who have already legalized same-sex marriage, we're seeing a decline in marriage in general. Heterosexual marriage and so-called homosexual marriage, it seems as though it's being cheapened to the point that nobody even wants any part of it. I just wonder what your comments were on that, because we're not hearing anything from the news about it.
Yeah, Craig, very good point. As a matter of fact, I've written about that in some of my commentaries and blogs. Great research done by people like Alan Carlson of the Howard Institute on the Howard Center. And just to give you one example, in Scandinavia, which has adopted so many of the most liberal sexual policies and laws imaginable, a book out just recently from Harvard University Press has a very interesting anecdote saying that researchers found that young married heterosexual couples in Scandinavia often felt that they had the burden to explain why they were married. Because the expectation was that you didn't need to get married. Marriage had been so weakened and undermined in the culture that whereas people would have to explain elsewhere why they were not married if they were living together and enjoying sexual relations and raising children and all the rest, in Scandinavia, these researchers with a completely secular point of view and a secular purpose, writing for Harvard University Press, said, look, these young people felt like they had to explain why they got married because it was so eccentric and indeed countercultural. That's a good point on which to end, and we'll pick up on this discussion again next week. For Intelligent Christian Conversation, this is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.